I'm going to move straight on now to a conversation I had with Melanie Cardwell of Nature's Pharmacy. I'll post some links into the chat box as we go along, hopefully. And this one's about 40 minutes long, so be back with you around 8 o'clock. 7 o'clock even.
I'm still at the Green Gathering, and I've got Mel, who's our herb lady, and at some of the festivals you do the first aid as well, but it's just the talks and the walks this time.
Yes, yeah, here at Green Gathering, yeah.
Yeah, and you seem to have had quite a few people following you around yesterday.
There's normally a small cluster, and then I had to wait longer for everybody to catch up yesterday, because there was probably about at least 20 people, which is really nice, actually. So it seems that there's more and more people out there that are interested in plants, which is really exciting.
Brilliant, yeah, indeed, yeah, and finding out kind of solutions in the raw, really, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
This is a lovely place to wander around in, because there's a mixture of woods, well, I guess it's woods and fields, there's a bit of cliffage over there. Where did you take them?
We went through the Enchanted Fairy Wood and surrounding areas, so you don't have to literally go very far when you're looking for plants. You could find some in a little tiny square, generally, of about 10 foot square.
Yeah.
And you can find probably at least 10 plants in that space, generally. Here we're a little bit more limited. There's more grass than anything else, although there are some beautiful trees.
Yeah.
So in and around, yeah, we found quite a few plants yesterday.
The trees are spectacular, actually, because it is a piece of old parkland, isn't it? So
yes. We've
got quite a lot of specimen trees. There are some fantastic old oaks.
There are. No real English oaks, though, actually.
They're all foreign. They're all different sorts, are they?
Yes, there's a lot of different other varieties.
The other thing is that, I mean, I'd expect with all of these kind of old trees and stuff to find quite a rich flora and fauna about the place, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
No, oddly enough. I think this was mainly sort of, I'm guessing, a lot of it planted up during the Victorian era, and around that time. And I mean, certainly the trees, like I said, there are a few native ones, but a lot of them are species that you wouldn't ordinarily find about, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And then a lot of it seems to have been taken over by many, many thistles.
yeah, the curse of the semi-used farmland, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's still a few medicinal plants that we found walking around yesterday, which was fun.
So what did you find?
A lot of the grass is inundated with yarrow. Yarrow is a common, very common plant, generally in hedgerows, ditches, and and gardens. It does grow a lot in lawns. And that's not so much in flower here, because obviously people are walking about, so the flowers haven't had chance to kind of establish themselves, but there's a lot of leaf in amongst the grass, and the leaf can be used as well as the flower, the whole aerial parts of yarrow, as an umbellifery. I don't know if you want me to describe it.
Certainly tell us what it's for. People can look it up.
They can look it up.
Yeah, to get a picture of
it. Its Latin name is Achillea millefolium. Millefolium meaning many leaves. So the leaves actually look like little feathers I always liken them to the feathers on a flight, an arrow flight.
Mm-hmm.
Achillea, named after Achilles. The story is that Achilles was dipped in as a Greek god, dipped in as a baby into the waters of immortal youth, immortal, made him immortal, except for where his mother held him on his ankle. And later on in life, as a warrior, he was shot in the ankle, that very ankle, by an arrow, and he bled to death. A yarrow is a styptic, among other things, which means it stops bleeding. So it's quite ironic, really, that it was used for that. And it was used many, many years ago on battlefields for wounds. They used to pack the bruised leaves and flowers into wounds to stop them bleeding. Mm-hmm. And if you're out in the field somewhere and you happen to have a nosebleed, for instance, I've actually done it myself where I've picked a yarrow leaf or two, bruised them up and stuffed them up your nose, and it actually stops the bleeding that way too, which is quite funny.
That's quite good, that, isn't it? Because I used to, as a youngster, I used to have really severe nosebleeds quite often, and there didn't seem to be any way of stopping them.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Now you know, yeah, if it ever happens again, mm, and you're out in the field somewhere, yeah, that will work.
It's true, isn't it? I think, or it's, at least it seems to be true, that the most common plants, the plants you find in most places, are often the most useful.
Yes, absolutely.
And one that stops bleeding is pretty good. And can, yeah, you use the flowers for anything?
Yeah, the flowers and the leaves you can make into a tea. You can take them internally. So I've known menstruating women who want a slower flow down if they're really heavy, and that will do an internal kind of slowing down of bleeding, and other internal bleeding if necessary. And it also is known as a diaphoretic, which means it will reduce a fever. It will, like, bring a fever up, but break the fever and take you the other side of it. That's a hot infusion, a hot tea of yarrow. The flowers and the leaves will help to break a fever. And also, a cold infusion, so a tea that you make that you've allowed to go cold, or you can put the flowers and the leaves into cold water and leave them for a couple of hours. That will help with menopausal women with hot flushes and night sweats.
Yeah.
So that will help to reduce those as well. So it's quite a useful little plant and very good for a lot of kind of menstruating women as
you
well.
You must have had quite a lot of, because I've known you've been doing this stuff for years, you must have quite a lot of experience of seeing this work with people.
Yes, I
now
do. Yeah, with lots of plants. And the bit I love more than anything else is the fact that a lot of these, most of these plants grow around us and under our feet most of the time. Mm. And they're there for, they're giving us the medicine that, you know, that nature provides. And it's just so easy if you know how. You don't have to drag loads in from other countries or anything else, because there's an abundance of them here, and they do work. Yeah, they have, yeah, done for millennia.
Yeah. So, what other plants have you found here?
Nettles. Most, yeah, people don't like the stinging nettle, but it is one of the richest food sources on the planet, I would say.
Although we get to eat it as soups and various, yes, other greens, yes, yes, certainly in the spring.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you can eat it all year round. What you need to do is, if you have a patch in your garden that kind of grows past kind of midsummer, past around July, you'll notice that the taller, older nettles have little frilly bits hanging off of them. Those are the flowers. Once they get to that stage, they can be a bit tough, and the chemical constituents in them change. So if you're eating those, they can become a bit of a stomach irritant. You can make cold infusions, cold teas from them, and hot teas, but you're only literally picking probably the first 2 or 3 inches off the top.
Just the tip.
The tip, really, with a few leaves on, six or eight leaves and the tops. But if you've got a patch in your garden that come up regularly, if you keep them cut regularly, you'll always get new little fresh ones, like, yeah, you would in the spring, and those are the best ones. They're the juiciest, they're the richest, yeah, ones you can use.
So keep yourself a well-pruned nettle.
Yes,
patch.
Absolutely. Yeah. They are literally a superfood. They've got very, very rich in iron, calcium and magnesium predominantly, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin, yeah, E, just a multitude of nutrition really in nettles, and I recommend people take them every day.
And they're found pretty much everywhere where human beings have been.
Absolutely.
There's quite often fertile ground underneath, so presumably, yep, they're gathering up trace elements as
they
well.
They do, yep. They are fantastic, yeah, absolutely.
And they do taste quite nice as well,
yeah,
I noticed in the soups. I was taking a bit of training, I must admit, to be gotten into the hedgerow soup.
I'd like to think more people would get into that kind of idea. And my daughter as a kid, I used to, because you can also eat them in salads, and you can pick the leaves, the young leaves, and put them into the salad bowl first and soak them in olive oil for 5 minutes. And then that takes the sting out of them.
Yeah.
And then you can add all your other leaves. Mm-hmm. So you can eat them raw, and that's obviously the best way to eat them. But I used to chop them up also quite finely on a board, like you would mixed herbs, yeah. fresh mixed herbs, and stir them into mashed potato and eat them that way as well. It makes the potato all lovely and green yeah. and herby. And that's another good way to eat them, you know, just in any which way, really. But it's great for kids.
Yeah, I suppose it's also true thinking about having them with vegetables. I mean, all the vegetables we know have been bred to the point where they no longer have the characteristics of their ancestors. But that's probably not true of things like the weeds, the plantains, the nettles, the elder, because elder's a really useful one as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Have you seen any of that about?
Yeah, we saw elder yesterday. Elder is, again, a really, really useful, fantastic plant. You can use the flowers and the berries medicinally and nutritionally, of course. And the leaves you can use, make into an oil, or just use them as they are, straight on the skin as a insect repellent if you're walking around in the woods, because it makes you smell nasty to little bitey things.
Well, elder flower.
Elder leaf.
Elder leaf.
The leaf.
You just rub it on.
Yes. Mm. Or you can make an oil up and you know, lather yourself in it. But
I wouldn't mind some of that for the Willow Theatre and the midges and stuff, because some of the things work for some people.
Yes.
I can't remember which one it is. Citronella.
Oh yes, citronella.
Works for some people, but it'd be useful for, because when they come in clouds, and it'd be useful to try other things.
Yes,
it would.
Yeah, you know, they'll definitely steer clear if you've covered yourself in elder.
Yeah.
A lot of people might as well, because it's not the most fragrant smell.
Oh, right.
But it will help.
Yes, indeed.
It definitely works.
I know the flowers give a real lift as well. I love elderflower cordial and the elderflower champagne.
The flowers are lovely. They have as many new medicinal properties as the berries. They're obviously only out for a short period of time, but they, if you collect them, you can dry them and use them. And then they're good in a tea. They're antiviral, antibacterial, anti-everything, really. I call elder our British echinacea.
Right.
And most people are familiar with the properties of echinacea in that it boosts the immune system and helps fight infection and everything else off. Well, elder will do the same thing, and you can use it all through the year. If, like I said, the flowers are only around in the summer briefly, but you can dry them and use them. I make elderflower cordial, elderflower champagne. That will last that little bit longer. And then the berries later on in the autumn, I put into either a honey or a maple syrup or a vegetable glycerine, which is a thick, sticky, clear liquid from a palm derivative. So it's vegetarian, vegan. And that I make a syrup from it, and I use that as a cough syrup, kind of cold flu thing in the winter. Great for adults and kids alike.
Yeah,
it's great.
And presumably you could do that sort of thing daily as
to
sort of maintain levels, not
absolutely
just, yeah.
Yeah, no, you take it on a daily basis right through the winter for sure, and it'll ward off getting any kind of coughs, colds and winter ailments. Yeah,
yeah,
for sure.
Any other bits of the elder that get used?
Like I said, no, mainly flowers, leaves and berries.
Yeah.
With that it's just such a lovely, really versatile medicine chest.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. And once again, it's really common.
Yes,
and
everywhere.
Know, difficult to kill.
Yes. Yeah, but you wouldn't want to. You wouldn't.
No,
want
some
to.
People do, but I mean, it's yeah. Nice, yeah. So what else did you find then?
We saw plantain yesterday. Plantain is nicknamed white man's foot. And it's normally found in every single lawn that I've ever looked in, predominantly. And you would imagine that in a space this big, you would find lots of it.
Well, there's lots of grass.
Well, yes. There's lots of grass. Mm. But actually, there's, like I said, more yarrow and a little bit of clover in this grass than plantain.
And that's it, isn't it? I mean, in nearly all the other festival sites we've been to, there's lots of variety in the grass.
Yes, there is.
So, at least around the edges. But
yeah,
here
absolutely.
It is. I can just see clover and grass. I mean, people would be proud of this as a lawn in Wales.
Yeah, there's the odd dandelion leaf, but that's normally very, very common, and there aren't a lot of those either,
no.
Although we did see a few yesterday.
And the plantain's another of those really useful plants, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Plantain, there's two different varieties. There's the broadleaf plantain, known as ribwort plantain, And then there's the skinny lance-shaped leaf plantain, known as Plantago lanceolata. Either one of those you can use. They're both really useful medicinally. They contain a very high quantity of antihistamine. So anyone, I use them for people with hay fever throughout the year, you know, at the beginning of the season or even before, to have one or two cups of tea of the leaves will help boost your body. So if you suffer with hay fever, it will ward it off essentially. And then if you get stung by nettles or bitey insects and things, as we've spoken about, a plantain leaf, again, either picked and just bruised up or chewed in the mouth for 30 seconds or so, and create what you call a kind of like a spit poultice and put directly on a bite or a sting, will also reduce it, cool the inflammation, reduce the inflammation, and basically take the sting away within seconds. It works really, really beautifully in a first aid situation in the middle of a field, as a tea, like I said, for sort of, you know, on a daily basis for hay fever. It also cleanses the blood, works very well at supporting the respiratory system. It's, again, a fantastic medicinal plant.
It's a miracle plant.
It is.
Could have done with some of that over in the crew kitchen, actually. I think, we're not sure whether it's mosquitoes or ants, but people are definitely getting bitten by things.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of sitting over a couple of days. It's swelling up quite big for a little and then going away again.
Yeah, I've had fantastic results with plantain, either variety, you know, here and abroad, actually, when I've been bitten. And it's something that I always carry with me in tincture form in my little first aid kit, just in case, you know, we're somewhere like we are here where there's very little.
I mean, the absence of docks and plantains and sorrels and stuff that you just see everywhere. Yeah. I was wondering if next time when we come, it might be worth bringing a few plants and bunging them in on the edge of the woodland, because if they would become established quite quickly,
they
I'm
would
sure.
indeed. Yeah, I that would be a nice idea.
I suspect they've been treated out here. Although, actually, that's odd, because I don't remember seeing farm or ground. I mean, it's a park, a farm, whatever it is. I don't remember seeing ground so dandelion free. Those weeds that we just see everywhere, it's
absolutely
quite spooky, really.
It is a little strange, yes, it is completely, but, you know, it's the way it's grown, it's the way it is. I mean, there are, like I said, there's plants about, but they are really few and far between.
Yeah.
Dandelions is another one that we did see a few of yesterday. Most, they're really common, obviously, and most people know them as a plant that will make you pee more, and they do. They're a diuretic, so they will help encourage your body to lose excess fluid.
Mm-hmm.
But they also they help the kidneys and the urinary system, and they also help the liver and the gallbladder. Hippocrates, the father of medicine, who created something called the Hippocratic Oath, has stated that plants with yellow flowers and parts, so some of them like the dock has a yellow root, dandelion with the yellow flowers, St. John's wort with yellow flowers, all of those kind of plants are very good for the liver, gallbladder and digestive system predominantly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a general rule, whereas red plants, things like chilies and hawthorn with its red berries and such, are really good for the blood and the circulatory system. And then blue flowers, mainly, like
more unusual. You see a lot of yellow and red.
You do, but
is
the blue. But the blue ones, there's a few that I could mention, like vervain and skullcap. There's one called Lobelia, which has got a nice bluey purple flower. Those are really good for the nervous system and support the nerves. So, and it's a general rule of thumb. It's not for everything. So dandelions are good for the liver, gallbladder and digestive system as well, and very good for detoxing and cleansing the bloodstream.
Which again is, I guess, I mean, that's one of the things I think that it's a good idea to concentrate a little on, is detoxing, simply because of the level of toxification that's going on now, one
absolutely
way or the other.
Yeah, It's a great, for me, it's something that I advocate wholeheartedly. I do detoxes myself and put my patients through in clinic through detoxing. I mean, after all, we MOT our cars every year. We have to, or they wouldn't allow them on the roads. And we spring clean our houses, most of us, and declutter and clear stuff out and clear spaces and take care of it and maintain it that way. But most of us don't think to clear our own bodies out on a regular basis. Considering, like you said, the amount of toxins that we kind of put into our body on a regular basis, a lot of it subconsciously, you know, without thinking, the coffee that we drink every day, or the tea, the alcohol, the sugars, the dairy, all of that, not least to say that if we don't eat organically, we've got pesticides and hormones in food and meat and nuts. It's quite important, and by doing so, we can actually keep our bodies well and healthy, so they're less likely to get sick, and prevention is better than cure any day.
It does seem to be the case, doesn't it, that if you do this stuff, then you do stay healthier?
Yes, most definitely. I've noticed it, certainly in myself and in my clinic.
Yeah.
It's very beneficial for anybody, you know. And there's varying degrees. You don't have to, with detoxing, you certainly don't have to fast and live on just water or juices. That's an extreme, but it is, I mean, it's beneficial.
Yeah.
But something as simple as spending a 2 or 3 days cutting down on certain things, that if you eat a lot of sugar, you want to cut that out and substitute, or just, you know, eat more healthily for a few days, you know, drink more water, that sort of thing, or herby teas.
If you let your body go through a couple of cycles, so 2 or 3 days without something, it gives it time to clear its system of it a little bit.
Absolutely, and that can be a really quite powerful detox for some people, you know, not least introducing herbs and things like that, just by giving your body a rest so it can allow it to do its job properly. Yeah, absolutely.
I've only recently discovered smoothies in my moving around the place. There's been 2 or 3 places where I've been given a kind of a juiced drink for breakfast.
Yes.
And I think that absolutely stunning. If you're going to have a day when, because many of us aren't used to not eating 3 times a day or twice a day or whatever it is. And I find that they're really good replacement, that I don't crave the food so much.
No. I think for, again, you know, I mean, that's a staple for me. My main thing for breakfast is a smoothie of some description, normally with a banana and fruit and things. And I put something together that's got I call it the green stuff, and it's got all my kind of nutrition in it that I have, that I add to my smoothie. And it's got things in it like nettles, it's got beetroot in it, because beets are very, very high in iron. It's got lemon peel in it and rose hips, you know, that you can pick dry, all powdered, because they're very rich in vitamin C, for instance. So it's got all my greens
do you make that yourself, or
I make that myself. It was based on a recipe from my herbal teacher in California nearly 20 years ago, and I put together this. My recipe is based on his, but I've been producing this now for about 8 years. And a lot of people, not myself included, but a lot of people in my clinic have found it really beneficial, because if you give your body the nutrition it needs at least once a day in a good assimilable form, and this, because it's in a powder and you have it in a drink like a smoothie, rather than taking a little vitamin and mineral capsule, it's all organic, wildcrafted powders. So I've got the spirulinas and chlorellas and wheat grasses and various things in there as well. If you do that, your body then absorbs 100% of it, because it hasn't got to do, it has very little digestion involved by taking it in that form. And within half an hour, it uptakes those nutrients, and you notice a real boost in energy, because it's very high in protein. There's spinach in it, for instance, like, you know, Popeye used to do, and, you know, with all the iron and other nutrients in. And it basically feeds your body. So your body then, all the cells in the body just love it. They lap it up. You really notice a difference in yourself from taking it. And then it takes care of other things as a knock-on effect. So skin problems disappear, digestive problems disappear, hormonal imbalances, all manner of things, because you've just eaten well, you know?
And really, quite often, the body only needs like tiny little doses of these things,
completely,
doesn't it?
Because yeah,
it can take the pattern of that.
It's one little 10-gram spoonful, or, you know, like a heaped kind of dessert spoonful a day.
Yeah.
And I really notice it when I don't take it.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could put it in with your muesli and things like
absolutely
that.
Absolutely. I've had people stir it into yogurt and eat it, or sprinkle it into cup of soups and have it for lunch, you know. Yeah. It's
it does sound like quite a good way of taking some of these superfoods, because obviously I've heard of lots of them over time. But I mean, if you were to go for all of this stuff and try and get through it, you'd never get time to get any food down you.
No, of course you wouldn't. So. No. And it's very simple, you know, if you're getting... I mean, I've got a friend who buys innocent smoothies because she hasn't got the time to literally whiz one up. And just adds it to that. But a smoothie, starting your breakfast off lightly like that, you're breaking the fast at the end of the day. And rather
or at
than
the beginning
give,
of the day.
Or the beginning of the day, yes, indeed. But whereas a lot of people sit down to a really big breakfast, I think it's, personally, certainly for me, I find that it's too much of a heavy load on your stomach that time in the morning. Mm. If you can start it off gently, and then it kind of sets you up for the day, effectively. And giving it the best start in that way, again, gives you that best, that energy and that kind of... impetus to get to go forward and start, and you're more likely to stick to a better diet. I think for a lot of people, again, I've noticed that if you start it off in that way, you know, rather than have like egg, bacon, sausage, which is nice every once in a while.
It's bizarre. It's something I've talked about before, but that's a transformation that I've gone through. That, you know, I used to be really into the pies and the full English breakfast and all that, and I used to really, I used the word despise, you know, lentil stews and all of that, and I really have moved bit by bit over the last 10 or 15 years to thoroughly enjoy and eating, and I've noticed that here. There is loads of really good food at the Green Gallery.
Yes, there is.
You know, the crew kitchen's turning out more or less entirely vegan food with maybe a bit of cheese on the side.
Nice.
But there's lots of other really great food around. There's not a lot of meat here.
No, there isn't. No, it's really, really nice to see, actually. Really nice.
Not a lot of beer either, has to be said. There's just cider.
Yes.
It's just this wicked cider bar.
We're in cider country, though, aren't we, down this way? There's a lot more apples and things.
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose so. The beer they have got is very good, it has to be said.
Okay. Yeah. Limited ale, but yes.
So you've got another walk in today, have you?
I've got a walk this afternoon at 1. We'll hopefully find a few more plants and such, and trees, because there's quite a few trees out and about that are medicinal as well.
So what sort of use can the trees be put to?
There's hawthorn, for instance. There's a lot of hawthorn around here, which is another really beautiful common plant. I mentioned
it
earlier with...
It is
everywhere. Most people know hawthorn. Mm. And you can use the flowers, the leaves and the berries. So it's very, again, versatile and all year round. The berries have a stronger medicine than the flowers and the leaves. The flowers, obviously, in the spring. I think all over the country, people used to... Years ago, when the first little flower buds, leaf buds come out in the spring, pick them and eat them. I know I certainly used to as a kid, and they're really quite sweet.
Yeah.
They were known as bread and cheese, apparently. And the hawthorn itself has many nutrients in it, not least flavonoids, bioflavonoids, that help support the heart and the circulatory system. So they re-elasticate veins, they can lower blood pressure, reduce cholesterol, they have natural beta blockers in it. The berries, I say, are stronger than the leaf and the flowers, but they all contain those constituents to certain degrees.
And can the flowers be dried like the elderflower?
Yes, you could dry them. You could dry the leaves and the flowers. They're obviously better fresh, but like I said, they're only about for a short period of time. In the autumn, when the berries are out and nice and ripe, red and juicy, I've made hedgerow jam, which is a nice way to preserve them and use them on a daily basis. A nice raw jam mixed with blackberries or elderberries or a mixture of them. And hawthorn berries, haws, as they're known, have a natural pectin in. So they will set a nice jam quite naturally anyway.
Yeah, so you can mix them in with other sorts of jam too.
You could, absolutely. The hawthorn berries have quite a large stone in the middle of them, so you'd have to sieve them through, and you wait till they've sometimes till they've had a bit of a frost on them and they're a little bit soft. Mm-hmm. And then you can literally just kind of put them through a sieve, and the pulp is what you use. And then the stones you obviously discard. You can throw them in the hedgerow and grow more hawthorns.
Yeah.
That would be really nice. Yeah. Give them back to nature. But yeah, a fantastic heart tonic, hawthorn, so all round actually.
It really sounds like the berry's the way of preserving that goodness.
Yes. Yeah. You can also make something called hawthorn leather, which is another way of preserving the fruit, you know, from the berry, into drying it either in, I mean, I use a dehydrator in my pharmacy, but you can make the pulp, mix it with, make it sort of with a little bit of water, maybe a little bit of sugar if you want, but it's not necessary, or honey, and then make like a paste that you lay out on a sheet, and you very, very slowly dry it in a very cool, low oven, or in a dehydrator, or an airing cupboard, if you like, over a couple of days, and that kind of forms like a fruit leather. And then you can tear that off in strips, and that's a nice way to preserve it and eat it on a daily basis as well, the berries.
Like a kind of fruity biltong.
Yes, exactly. Just like that, yeah. And if you've got heart problems, or they run in the family, or you just want to kind of tone your whole circulatory system and the heart and strengthen the blood and the vessels and such, hawthorn's the way to go. Mm-hmm. And it is in abundance. It's beautiful, beautiful herb.
The house that we last lived in had a disused railway line behind it, which was lined with hawthorn on both sides. And there were a couple of years when all of them were just covered in berries. And do you know, every single one of them was a different red.
Yes.
As you look down this railway line, it was, you think red is red, but because it was straight, you could see maybe half a mile along it.
Indeed.
And my eyes could distinguish just the difference in red in all these.
Oh, how
just
lovely.
Really beautiful.
The nice thing I like about the spring as well, when the hawthorn comes out around May time, is that there's also varying degrees of kind of from white to pink to really deep red flowers.
That's true too,
as well. And they're different varieties, but they're all mixed in our hedgerows. And it's really lovely to see that kind of. And the leaves also, if you really notice, especially in the spring, have a red tinge to them too, which is really quite lovely. So it's a beautiful common shrub in this part of, well, in the UK.
Oh, it's been commonly used as a hedging plant, hasn't it, for a long, long time.
Many, many
so it's
years.
Actually managed to survive the depredation of farming because it's one of the last little bits that's left.
Yeah.
Sometimes you see them forming trees, don't you, out of old hedges, but.
Yes.
So have you got a website that people can go to contact you?
Well, I've got two actually, because I've been obviously doing this for nearly 20 years now. And product wise, I make a lot of kind of herbally teas and formulas, and my greens, of course, and such. And I make a whole range of natural skincare and beauty products more skincare and such, and massage
toning.
But it's for me, it's important to not only be aware of what you put into your body, but also what you put externally on your body, and then that also has an effect on the environment. So that website is naturespharmacy.org.uk. And then more recently, in the last sort of 5 or 6 years, I've gone more into teaching as well, because I really think that education's where it's at. You can reach more people that way. And as I said in the beginning, there's more people out there that really want to know about plants. And it's really important, I feel. My passion is getting back to just giving people the basics about what they can use in their kitchens with spices and foods and herbs, and also in the hedgerows and underfoot.
And again, the spices and herbs remain relatively unchanged over
time.
They've still got their qualities.
And there'll be common ones like garlic and ginger and chilies and thyme and such that most people have in their kitchens.
Yeah.
That have medicinal and nutritive properties. So the teaching side is where a lot of my focus is, but like I said, I dance between the two, and at festivals like this, my big thing is herb walks and just getting people re-empowered to knowing what's out there.
I think it's fantastic, really, because I've actually seen almost the death of that information, the kind of reduction of it into very, very few heads.
Yes.
And it's really great now to see again and again, and actually in loads of different contexts, not just here. I know at the Willow Theatre, they do herb and foraging walks. And
nice.
So, and you see more and more people doing them, so I think you're right, that is the way to go. Rather than selling people a product, give them the knowledge.
Yes, give them the knowledge and they can make their own, which is what I like to do too.
And some of it is wicked. I mean, I think one of my main medicines since I discovered homeopathy has become Hypericum.
Yes,
Hypericum
St.
oil,
John's
Hypericum
wort.
Tincture.
Yes, yes.
It is just a miracle.
It's an incredible, incredible, and very, it's not given in a good light necessarily, because there are certain contraindications with St. John's wort that if people were made aware of, would honour it in a better light, certainly. But it's a very useful herb internally and externally, and very magical too.
Yeah.
I was on a walk last weekend at a druid camp in West Wales, and it was growing, and I took kids with me, and it was a kids' walk. Mm. And St. John's wort flowers, which are yellow, when you squash them, have this really beautiful red dye in them. And I was just showing the kids the magic in that, because when you put the flowers into oil and infuse them, it turns the oil a really deep red, and it's fabulous externally on the skin. And the kids were just like, you know, gobsmacked that this lovely red, yellow flower was oozing this red juice, you know. And like I said, medicinally, internally and externally, it's a fantastic herb.
And that's why we start getting into the business of perhaps planting some of these things in your back garden.
Yes.
So that you can use them, because calendula, hypericum, they're very beautiful plants. They're
really
are. Easy
Indeed.
To grow.
Yes. Very easy. And it would be nice that because it would help those proliferate. It would also, I mean, there's an abundance of many herbs out there, but there's certain things, like, for instance, in this country, certainly in my neck of the woods in the east of England, used to be covered in marshmallow, and it was over farmed last century, and now it's very, very difficult to find, and it's a very useful plant. So if people were to start planting a few of these more in their gardens and introducing them into the wild a bit, then we would get those beautiful native plants back into this country, you know.
Yeah.
With the teaching side, I do workshops and courses and things, and little herb walks, and I'll do a herb walk at the drop of a hat. And if people wanted to go and find out more information about that, my website for that is herbcraft.info.
Yeah. Excellent. Just as a matter of interest, did you have any trouble with the Codex Alimentarius and the Advertising Standards Agency and the words you're using on your website?
That's interesting you should say that. I was first made aware of the Codex about 15 years ago when they first started to bring it to, you know, and I was still as kind of just coming out of my studies then, and we were all made aware of it. And then it kind of went underground for a bit. And last year, obviously, they brought it to the fore, and as it's kind of travelled the globe since then. In the UK here, they gave us a year's grace. So effectively, a few months ago, we should have all kind of tightened our belts and looked at wording and everything else. I've not had any major comeback from anybody necessarily in that department. I'm obviously careful with what you have to be reasonably careful with what you say. One-on-one with people is a lot easier. But I went to when it first came about last year, I went to a conference in London that was 200 people there. A lot of them were nutritionists, not many herbalists, about 50 herbalists. The majority were nutritionists. Because, of course, being a herbalist, qualified herbalist, I'm kind of covered by a governing body that we're all trying to get self-regulated, so at least people can know that they're going to come to somebody who's reputable and knows their stuff and can treat them. But even on a one-on-one, we're not allowed to, with this whole codex, where we were told that we can't really tell people that water is good for them.
Mm-hmm.
But we can make various suggestions in that direction. And we can't also really sit there and say that McDonald's might be bad for somebody. You know, the kind of fast food chain of food, McDonald's or whatever, in any of those. So we have to be careful about wording, for sure. But
that's
at the end of the day,
it
is a bit ridiculous, considering that medicine, herbal medicine, has been the oldest form of medicine known to man. It's been around for eons, and their biggest thing is that, you know, there's various contraindications. We can't let it out there to the public because we can't... We have to prove that it works. But, of course, it's been working for years and
years. And it's also been shown that if you eat McDonald's every day for 30 days, you're going to do yourself irreparable
absolutely.
Damage.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, you know. I think most of it is a question of dosage. It's respect for the plants. It's a question of dosage. I was talking to someone just yesterday who was saying that, you know, even with water... is dangerous. Water could even be a poison because, you know, if you were to drink gallons and gallons within a 10-minute period, you can drown.
And people have.
Yeah, exactly.
People
they have
killed themselves by drinking too
of
much water.
Of course they have, you know. So it's a question of respect. It's a question of common sense most of the time, Nick. You know? And so I'm... The good thing, I think, about the Codex that's come out for me, and I maintain the positivity around it, rather than look at it from a negative perspective, is that by taking a lot of things off the shelves, I've noticed myself personally, in the last year specifically, that there are more people, because they can't find their herbal remedies where they used to find them, you know, they're either going through the internet, where there's a whole host of herbal remedies still available out there, like myself, and they're also wanting to find their own remedies. They want to go out there. They don't want to be reliant on Big Pharma.
I wouldn't want to be without my hypericum and calendula, my hypericum tincture, the hypericum oil. I have like half a dozen of these things, which really are... crucial to
absolutely.
Me for, under various circumstances, and I really wouldn't want to be without them.
No. So there are more. It's highlighted the herbal world to the extent that people are now standing up and going, hang on a minute, you can't take my herbs away from me, and I'm if you're going to plan to do that, then I'm going to go out there and find them myself, you know?
Brilliant.
And that excites me.
And that's exactly what we want, isn't it?
It is.
It means that instead of somebody walking in somewhere and handing over some meaningless promissory tokens for a little bottle...
Absolutely.
They're actually getting the knowledge and going out. And it means they're getting the fresh air.
Yes.
They might be getting a bit of gardening.
Yes,
in,
yes,
a bit
yes.
of alchemy.
Absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely.
All of it.
There's something else that I read. I was speaking to a friend. Oh, in fact, you know him. Mikhail was telling me the other few weeks ago that there is now, apparently, it's been proven that there is something called nature deficiency disorder. Particularly with children, where too many kids sit in front of their computers, they sit in front of their PlayStations and laptops, you know, and TV, and they don't get out in nature like we used to as kids and run around. And this will encourage them and hopefully parents and such to get back out there and be in nature, because it's such a healing modality on its own, not least with the plants that are out there.
So
I think there's good things. I think you've always got to look at the positive side of everything.
It's all moving.
It's all moving.
I think no matter what it looks like. And I really do believe that quite often, the kind of... Well, we can't tell what the results of any given project, outing or policy are going to be.
No.
But anything that encourages people to get out there and start interacting with plants and trees and the like.
Absolutely.
Just that. You don't even have to go for the eating of the tips or the tea.
Just
sitting with
connection.
Your back against a tree does help,
absolutely.
Doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's just that connection. Yep. Mm. There's so much out there.
Brilliant. Well,
thank you.
That was excellent. Thank you very much, Mel.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Well, that was me in conversation with Melanie Cardwell at this year's Green Gathering. We were, as you can probably tell, sitting in a van with a bit of rain falling on it and Shaman drumming away in the background. But as regular listeners will know, that was a relatively quiet recording from the field. Sometimes they're extremely noisy. So Mel's hopefully going to be joining me in sort of 10 or 15 minutes or so to talk a little bit about what we can use from the kitchen to effect first aid on people. And later on, as I said, we'll be talking to the Synchro Sister after Doc. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation that I had with Mel over at the Green Gathering, and she's agreed to come on and talk a little bit more, because as you can probably tell, we were just skittering over the top of one part of her knowledge, really. And I know that another subject she covers, because she does first aid at some of the festivals for the Avalon Rising crew, And I know that another of her specialities is first aid from the kitchen. So hopefully she's online and can hear me, and you'll be able to hear her. Are you out there, Mel?
Yes. Hi, Nick.
Brilliant. Well, I can hear you all right. If you, it's great. Thanks a lot for joining us on TNS Radio.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
No worries. Well, what would you say is are the most commonly kind of accessible things that are available in a kitchen for doing first aid? I know that the vinegar here seems to be made a lot of use of.
Yeah, vinegar's very good. So's lemon juice for varying things. there's actually a whole host of herbs and spices in the kitchen that one can use for first aid situations, and also obviously nutritionally in food one healthy.
Can I just interrupt a minute? I can hear TNS Radio in the background there.
Ah, hang on a second. Yeah, that's we had that on in the kitchen. Let me turn that off in some form. Bear with me one second. My apologies.
That's okay. We like to give people that little time shift experience when they first come on.
Let's do that.
Because your radio's running about 40 seconds behind your speech, which can which can lead to some quite confusing feelings.
Okay, so I don't know how to do this other than to close it down, so I'll do that.
You just press the play button and it'll pause.
How's that better? Is that any better?
Yeah, that's better. I can't hear you now. That's great. I can hear you, but
I did wonder because I thought I was having an echo.
No, you're all right now. That'll make it a lot easier to think, I reckon.
Yes.
Well, yeah, carry on the vinegar. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Vinegar itself neutralizes wasp stings as the first thing that comes to mind. Wasps, bee stings, you normally use bicarb of soda, which most people have in their kitchen. And I've used that to great effect. In fact, I had a friend at a festival who trod on a bee, and all I had to hand was my tooth powder, which contains bicarb of soda, and we put that on, and that healed the bee sting.
Oh, brilliant.
But vinegar, they say, for wasps, and bicarb for bees. So vinegar will neutralize, because it's alkaline, it will neutralize wasp stings. It will also help to some extent externally on other bites and stings as well. It's internally, it's very good for digestion and for balancing stomach acids, and aiding digestion and alkalizing the body and the blood, which is important, especially when one's detoxing.
Yeah. So what else can we find in the kitchen then?
Okay. One of my favorite herbs is cayenne. That's chilies or capsicum species. I used this in a first aid situation many years ago when my daughter was younger. She was swinging between two countertops in the kitchen and slipped, and she wore glasses. She was about 7 or 8 years old, as I recall. And she cut the top of her eye. The glasses caught the top of her eyebrow next to her eye. And I was cooking at the time in the kitchen with the chili pepper, the cayenne pepper, and dabbed a little bit of that on the top of her eye where it was bleeding, and held her for about 5 or 6 seconds, and it stemmed the bleeding. So cayenne powder or chilies, but cayenne powder is normally to hand in a kitchen, will stem bleeding. It's a styptic, so it will stop bleeding in seconds. Sting just a tiny bit.
Yeah, I thought that. I can attest to that one myself, because out there in the garden with my sharpened tools, I quite well, not less frequently nowadays, but I still do occasionally inflict quite a serious bleeding wound, and that stuff is practically miraculous.
It is indeed. Yeah. You can also use it internally if you've got sort of internal bleeding, as it will slow down bleeding. So I've actually had women that can take like a little half a teaspoonful of cayenne in a glass of warm water, and honey if you prefer to sweeten it a little bit, and it will help to slow down a menstrual flow if one's suffering from a very heavy period. It's a wonderful cardiac stimulant. Cayenne helps to equalize blood pressure as well. So someone, and again, I've used this in the first aid situation, if someone is having heart palpitations, high blood pressure, where they're getting very dizzy, spaced out, or feeling very faint. Likewise, with low blood pressure, cayenne has the ability to equalize blood pressure in the body. And again, you would take it, you know, just as I suggested, with a teaspoonful, or maybe, you know, working from quarter to half a teaspoonful. If you suffer with heart problems, you can take it on a daily basis, once or twice a day, and it will help to maintain a strong, healthy heart and circulatory system.
Well, that's really useful, isn't it? Because that's one of the things that I've encountered as a GP that insisted I was in need of some kind of blood pressure pill. And I gather that there's many, many millions of people using these things across the nation now.
There are indeed. It's quite frightening.
And the other thing is these herbs and spices and stuff appear to work. If you're using them in a first aid situation, they seem to work really like fast, really immediately.
They do. Yeah, they do just as easily and obviously more naturally than using something from your first aid kit. And it's obviously very useful to know certain things in the kitchen that will do just that, you know, so you can use them, you know, to hand at home with family and friends and such, and not have to get your drugs out of the cupboard, so to speak.
Well, and even that, it's very difficult to think of one that effectively stops bleeding in any first aid kit.
Right. Well, yeah, no, true. I can't think of it myself, actually. I have used it in various situations. You mentioned before that I've done first aid. I used to do it at the Out of the Ordinary festival I did for about 4 years on the trot, actually.
I saw some of the things you had to do.
From there, we've used cayenne on the spot situations out in the field also in the form of a tincture. Which I don't go anywhere without, actually.
Yeah.
So chilies are one of my favorite herbs in the kitchen, particularly, and I would recommend to anybody. They're also nutritionally, if I may add, very, very rich in iron, vitamins A, B, and C, lots of antioxidants. And like I said, they're a really good food for boosting and supporting the circulatory system.
So it wouldn't really do any of us any harm to be drinking sort of one or two of those a day.
No, absolutely. Or just include chilies in your diet, you know. I have something that I teach on my kitchen herb craft workshops and to my students, which I'd like to share with your listeners, if I may. And that is, I make three different pastes that are staples in my kitchen. You can use, again, you know, use them in first aid situations or on a daily basis just for good health. And that is a chili paste, a cayenne, a garlic paste, and a ginger paste. And it's basically fresh herbs, so fresh chilies in a jug, or fresh ginger chopped up, or fresh garlic cloves, with a little bit of olive oil added and whizzed up in a hand blender to a sort of paste, and then a teaspoonful of apple cider vinegar that we mentioned in the beginning, which helps to preserve that. You can then just make it a fresh paste that you can use at the end, towards the end of your cooking is always best, because they that way you've always got the raw properties of the herb there, essentially. And you haven't got to, you know, you're not cooking the herb to lose a lot of the properties in the cooking process. Yeah. And you can add it as a condiment at the side of your plate. Yeah. And if you like, I'm happy to talk about ginger and garlic as well, and their nutritional and medicinal properties.
I think that'd be a good idea, because they're fairly common about the place. I'm really glad to hear you say that, because I'm a bit of a fiend for your occasional hot sauce. And I like to go to these to sort of places like the Melton Road in Leicester and visit foreign delicatessens, sort of Asian places and the like, where you can get all manner of things. And at one stage, my brother did give me a jar of this bright, lurid orange stuff that was, in fact, minced chili, garlic and ginger.
And wicked.
It was really brilliant, because what I didn't realize, I did cook with it a bit, but mostly I just had it on the side of the plate, but because it was really hot. And you got the ginger first. You really got to taste the ginger, then the garlic, and then the chili came on. It was it really was a bit of a firework of an experience in terms of eating.
It sounds absolutely delicious, and I'd love some.
I'll see if I can get some more next time I'm passing through Leicester.
Well, thank you very much. So with garlic, I would imagine most people are aware that it's kind of been around as far as Hippocrates, the father of medicine, which goes back sort of nearly 400 BC. And he used garlic himself for a variety of infections and intestinal disorders, as well as sort of open wounds, toothaches, and various other things. We call it a natural antibiotic, or probiotic, I prefer to say, because pro meaning for and bio meaning life, as antibiotics tend to kill everything off in the gut, which is obviously not conducive to a good digestive system. It's also a really good expectorant, and it lowers blood pressure. It will lower cholesterol naturally by taking garlic in your diet, and it will stimulate the circulation as well.
And by expectorant, we mean?
Expectorant, normally if you have a really bad cough and you've got a phlegmy cough and you want to get rid of a load of mucus from your lungs, it will help that to release and help bring it up. That's what I mean by expectorant. Thank you.
And does it have to be raw?
Raw is preferable. Oddly enough, there's a lot of people out there that take garlic capsules, odorless garlic capsules, for instance. It's the smelly bit in garlic, the allicin, that's actually the really potent bit. So it's important to take it and take the smelly bit with it. And raw is always best. So if people are worried about garlic breath, there's another herb that most people have in their gardens called parsley, which taken after your garlic will help to freshen your breath because of the chlorophyll content in it.
And it tastes really nice too.
It does indeed, yes.
And has its own benefits, I'm sure.
Sorry?
And has its own benefits.
It does have its own benefits, not least that it really helps flush through the kidneys as a diuretic. So it helps eliminate excess fluid. It's really good for all kinds of arthritic, rheumatic, gout, inflammatory problems, basically, and kidney and urinary health. Parsley, it's really, really wonderful. Plus, it's got a host of vitamins and minerals in it.
Yep, so there you go, garlic and parsley together.
Yes, absolutely.
Sounds like a fairly palatable mix to me.
Indeed. Garlic is also a really good one as a cold and flu remedy, and good taken through the wintertime. Just to, like I said, as a preventative, really, just to kind of ward off coughs and colds. And I make another little, I call it winter elixir or a hooch. Fondly known as hooch in this household, which is garlic, ginger, chilies, onions, and horseradish, all whizzed up in apple cider vinegar. Oh. And if you haven't tasted that, I would recommend you try it because it's absolutely delicious.
That sounds absolutely great. Sounds right up my street, that one does.
Yes, it probably would be. It's quite pokey, horseradish. Has a nice that hot flavour to it, but all the herbs blended together will guard against coughs and colds, strengthen the immune system, strengthen the digestive system, and improve circulation, all of which you need through the winter months for sure.
And of course, I'm not sure we can cultivate ginger in these islands, but we can certainly cultivate horseradish, can't we?
Oh yes, it grows wild in most places. Certainly where I live in East Anglia, it's all over the place.
Right.
And it's one that I point out to many people on herb walks, because wild horseradish in its abundance is, and it's about ready, coming up around now. You don't need much of it, so it would be really, really useful as a cold and, like I said, a cold and flu chest remedy and boosting the immune system.
Can you actually buy, can you get hold of horseradish in the shops here?
Where I live, on my local market, from about September, October time, They have, on the fruit and veg stall on the market, small jars of it, and it is pure grated horseradish with nothing added. So no vinegars, no mayonnaise to make it into sort of like a, you know, a horseradish sauce that you'd have with your beef, for instance. Mm-hmm. And it's about £1.50 a jar, and I can buy it, like I said, locally. My recommendation would be, if you don't grow it in your garden and you're going to dig it up somewhere, you know, in where it grows profusely and not necessarily by the road or a sprayed field, you won't need more than one or two little roots, would be to wear a mask if you're going to do it yourself, because it's and take the blender outside, because your tears will be streaming from your eyes. It's that potent, but it shows you the power of that particular plant.
Yeah, indeed. And it's another one of those that roots quite deep. So it's pulling up a lot of minerals and stuff from deep in the earth, isn't it?
It is indeed. Yes. Yeah. Like a lot of roots. Absolutely. And minerals are what we're lacking mainly in our diet because of the amount of pesticides that we've had in, you know, sprayed in the fields over the decades. The food that we actually eat doesn't contain anywhere near the amount of nutrition that it should do.
And that's why this stuff that kind of grows in untreated ground on sort of, you know, the edges of woods and in places I've always known, there tends to be always really fertile areas where you see stinging nettles. So where things like horseradish are growing close to them, there's going to be a lot of good stuff in them. But the ones that haven't been cultivated have remained pretty much as powerful as they were in the old days, haven't they?
Yes, of course. Oh, absolutely. And they're still out there in abundance. It was really nice at a festival I was at the other week in Norfolk, actually, where I took a few herbs in pots, and I took specific salad vegetables, but old varieties like Good King Henry and Chenopodium family, that is, and Fat Hen, both of which grow on our sort of waste ground and edges of fields quite profusely, and they're old varieties linked in with grains like amaranth and quinoa that grow in more warmer climes, but they're full of protein and very beneficial nutritionally for us, and readily available.
Brilliant. It's all amazing, isn't it, that there's just this entire wealth of stuff out there and nobody out, well, not many people anyway, going out there to get at it.
I know. There's an abundance out there. I'd really like to think there's more and more people getting into this and going out and wild foraging for their own stuff, because that's where we need to go effectively.
Well, as we said, we're certainly seeing a rise in that sort of thing at the festivals where people are basically giving out information. There's more people doing the teaching and more people coming for the learning, I think.
Yes. Yeah. No, I'd be inclined to agree with you there.
And you, because we had, as well as yourself, we had Fred Gillam at the Green Gathering, didn't we?
We did indeed. Lovely man. Yes.
I know that Synchro will be talking a little bit about his work later on. You're right. He was a really lovely man. So I was thinking actually about your reference to the first aiding at the Out of the Ordinary course, and I remember a couple of classic bruisings. I remember the captain of our team hitting himself in the shin with the back of a splitting axe.
Yes.
And I also remember that man who caught, he was a bit out of it, and he decided to make a sudden return to juggling those Skittles. Do you remember? And he caught one in the eye.
Oh, yes,
do you remember
I
that?
Do.
So do you have anything for bruising?
Bruising, okay. Bruising, there's two things that come to mind initially. One of them would be lavender as an essential oil, which most people hopefully keep in the kitchen. That works a treat for bruising, burns, bite stings, and any kind of a sort of small open wound, spot, that sort of thing. And the other thing would be arnica, that I hope most people are familiar with. It's a herb that grows, it can grow in this country, beautiful herb, but we don't use it necessarily in herbal medicine, but homeopathically, arnica is renowned for bruising specifically.
Yeah, that's another one that, like the hypericum I was talking with in the previous chat we had, I use arnica all the time.
And yes.
It's a little known fact that you can actually take it in advance of shock and bruising as well. So I use it quite extensively before I go to the dentist.
You can indeed, yeah. Or if you're going to go into surgery or something like that, another good situation where you can take it beforehand and it works a treat. Or if not, then you can take it, obviously, at the onset of an accident, or in a first aid situation, or when you come out of hospital or back from the dentist, yeah. It will still work the same. And you can take it internally in the form of little pilules. I always carry some in my van, in my first aid box, and I have some in my kitchen at home. And then there's also, they also make something called Arnica cream, which you can put externally on as well, which works a treat.
It does, and it works, again, like many of the other remedies we're talking about, it seems to me to work pretty instantly.
It does.
And and of course, it really it speeds up your healing as well as kind of dealing with it immediately. It makes things get better a lot more quickly, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. So, another good plant that does that is comfrey. Most people have comfrey growing in their gardens.
Oh, yeah, go for comfrey for a bit, because, again, it's one of those plants that's very easy to cultivate and has loads and loads of really good reasons for having it in the garden, and it reaches deep, deep, deep down into the soil.
It does indeed. I've made poultices from comfrey root, and you don't need much. Again, you can pull up some like you would with horseradish and dandelion. The roots go down very, very deep, as you say, and you only need to pull up just a small amount of that and leave the rest in, and then you're going to still end up leaving the plant in there so it will continue to grow. So you're only harvesting part of that. And the comfrey, it's got a mucilaginous effect, which is really nice because it kind of goes slimy, but it's very soothing. When you mash it, the root up, or you could also use the leaves above ground. They have a similar effect, perhaps not so quite so gloopy, but still work at bruises again, like the arnica, and for sprains and sort of anything from that to broken bones, you can apply externally around the area and cover it and leave it on for several hours. That will help. And I also use the root and the leaves just chopped up in some extra virgin olive oil, whizzed up and then put in a jar and left in the sun for a minimum of 2 weeks, will make a really fab oil that you can use externally on anything, you know, bruises again, cuts, wounds and broken bones and sprains.
Oh, that's really great, because they're quite often things that are much better seen to kind of instantly on site.
Absolutely.
I remember when Synchro broke her arm, it was actually a fair, they wanted us to drive to Hereford. It was kind of getting it to night and things, and it was like 45, 50 mile drive or something, or she could have it seen to at the local hospital in the morning. And right. One of the things about breaks is that they really need to be attended to quite quickly, don't they?
They do indeed, yeah.
We did actually just lay her down and take her to the local hospital in the morning, and they did a really fine job, but it would have been really helpful to have known about that, because we could have done a bit of stuff then, couldn't we?
Yes, absolutely. It's also a cell proliferant, which means that it speeds the healing process up and creates more cells faster. So it will heal a wound in twice as fast.
Amazing. So that's another good one. What else have you got in your little bag of tricks then?
Well, moving on from that, there's a plant that most people, again, have in their houses and kitchens, and that is aloe vera.
Oh, yes. Yep. That's a fairly well-known one.
That also is a cell proliferant, so that will also speed healing up. And it also is absolutely brilliant for burns to put on in a first aid situation. Again, obviously, depending on the degree of the burn, because if you have a burn that you just kind of burn yourself while you're cooking and you've got a very gentle sort of what I'd call a first degree burn, or even down to a second degree where you a few more layers of the skin have been burnt. Any burn needs to go under cold water, depending on the degree of it, for at least a minimum, I would say, of 10 minutes to 30 minutes under ice cold water, as cold running water as you can get, to stop the burning, because your skin, once it's burnt, tends to continue to burn. But once you've done that, you can apply aloe vera gel directly from the plant, from a leaf, directly to the burn externally, and it will help to heal it again and form sort of like a little bandage over it, so it seals it as well and aids the healing process almost instantly.
I've been told recently that the sort of aloe vera that we see in most people's houses isn't the one that's supposed to be used for that, but I've always found it quite effective. Maybe it's just because I believe it's going to work.
Well, it's to my knowledge, it's always been an aloe vera to me, and it has the perfect gel, and it is the one that most people, I think, are aware of. There are a very many varieties of aloes out there. Many of them obviously grow in the desert and not in our in native to this country. But most people have a small aloe vera plant that they'll have sitting on their windowsill somewhere in the house. And as long as it's got a kind of a clear gel within it, that you can break off the leaf. The leaf has sort of little white flecks on it. And then generally, contrary to popular belief, like a little bit of water as opposed to being starved of water.
Yeah, it's just that they withstand being starved of water, but they do like to drink.
They do like to drink, yep, they do indeed. That would be a perfect plant to use in those kind of first aid situations.
I've certainly always found it effective, and it literally does have the gel within it, doesn't it? You can just kind of squeeze the end of it and it comes out like a sort of a bit like a jelly, really. So it provides its own coating.
And that's it. Yeah.
And again, I can warrant the running of the burn under the tap, because again, I mean, I think we all cop for burns. There's plenty of hot things around the place nowadays. And I've found that it needs to be run under the tap until it stops stinging when you take it out from under the tap.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And then you know that you can proceed with your aloe vera, with your lavender oil if necessary, or if, you know, depending on the degree of. I've also used, put a little bit of cling film on, which is the kind of best thing for a burn if you're going to, depending on, again, on the, you know, severity of it. But if you're going to rush off to the hospital afterwards, you put a little bit of aloe on. And then put some cling film over to kind of keep it clean, but also to protect it. And again, you know, before you rush off to get perhaps more medical attention if necessary.
Yeah, my experience of these things as well is that it results in the thing more or less repairing itself without any visible damage.
It does indeed.
This kind of attention, like I say, immediately at the scene. And again, they're all really relatively simple things. In fact, the I remember the cold running water thing is what we can do when we've got a tap. But, yep, you know, outside in a forest school situation or a camping situation where there might not be any running water close by, if you've got a bucket of cold water or something and can immerse the burnt part, that works as well, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Yes, it does.
In fact, yep. I think that some of the people at Hiroshima managed to get themselves into the river fully immersed whilst the actual action was going on, and as a result managed to stay in much better nick to a certain extent, obviously.
Yes, they did.
so it works, yes. Works for pretty much all levels of burn, water and burns.
It does indeed. Yep. So that's aloe. The other herb that comes to mind initially would be chamomile. I've used chamomile for lots of soothing situations in first aid situations in the home. Chamomile's not least it. I mean, I've used it for various things, everything from sort of indigestion to colic, heartburn, to even eye problems, like, you know, styes, or you know, where people have got stingy eyes from hay fever and things like that. Chamomile tea bags, most people would have that in their kitchen these days. Those certainly into their herbs would have chamomile in a tea bag. If you were going to use it sort of as a soothing eye patch, if you like, for eye problems, to irritation and such, you can place a cooled chamomile tea bag, one that you've already used, for instance, over the eyes, and leave that to cool and work. You can also make a chamomile tea and get a little bit of cotton wool, dip that in the tea, squeeze it out a little bit and moisten it, but and bathe the eyes that way, or use the tea itself in a little eye bath and bathe your eyes. I've used that, like I said, for various eye problems. And then internally, chamomile, this is little known actually, because most people drink chamomile tea for its soothing and sedative effects, which are renowned, and taken before bed It will even help as a remedy for nightmares, it's been told, but it will help make you sleepy and ease your sleeping pattern and help you sleep by relaxing the nerves. But if you make a strong cup of chamomile tea, and this is important for those that have had to take antibiotics, for instance, or have any kind of upset tummy, it will work. A strong cup will help to repopulate essential bowel flora. So it works like a poor man's acidophilus. And that's what I nickname it, because it's very useful, like I said, for any kind of digestive upset, from indigestion to colic, heartburn, diarrhea, you know, that you want to kind of relieve almost instantly. And like I said, from a first aid situation, a strong chamomile tea, leaving the bag, I would say, in the cup for up to 5-10 minutes, let it go slightly cold, and then drink it, you know, will work beautifully in that kind of situation.
And again, it's another plant that's really easy to cultivate. It looks nice.
Absolutely.
And looks nice in the garden. It's fragrant in sort of sunny air, and it's also very attractive, I think, to pollinating insects and the like.
Yes.
So it sounds like a real bargain, that one, because you can actually get a cup of tea out of it and then use the tea bag as a poultice as well.
You can indeed.
In these hard up times, at least that's a bit of forward movement, eh?
Yes.
What other of the herbs are useful? Can we do stuff with marjoram and things?
All the marjorams, oreganos, I'm just trying to think of a whole bunch of most of those kind of herbs. They're all specifically, or predominantly, I should say, digestives. So they would aid any kind of digestive upset, a little like the chamomile. If you didn't have that to hand, you could use marjoram, oregano. There's spices that most people have, like cinnamon. Fennel is another one that most people have growing in their garden, or they have the seed in their herb cupboard, or fennel, you know, fennel seed powder. That's even a really good one for babies. Chamomile is also very safe for babies as well, as a tea, that is. Ginger, all of those kind of herbs would be really prime digestives. So they're really, really beneficial for aiding any kind of digestive upset. Predominantly that's what springs to mind, and they also flavor the food and are really lovely to add. Again, I like to have things raw rather than cooked, so my preference is to add them, chop them finely, and add them to salads, so you can eat them alongside your cooked food, to get the most benefit from them, essentially.
Yeah, fennel's another gorgeous plant that can be easily cultivated here as well. It's very tall, indeed. And it's an umbellifer, isn't it, I think?
It is.
And it's another one that attracts absolutely well. I mean, not so much this year, but it attracts normally clouds and clouds of different sorts of insect around it. I can watch them for ages, and tastes a bit of licorice, doesn't it?
It tastes a little bit like licorice, so which is useful, like I said, for the digestive system. It's also an expectorant, like we mentioned before, helping to release excess mucus from the lungs. It helps relieve excess fluid from the body via the kidneys, and it's got very strong antimicrobial properties. So fennel, you know, I've known people in India, for instance, use fennel seed to wash their hands. And the oil, the essential oil that's in the seed, by rubbing the seed together with your hands, helps to eliminate bacteria.
Very good. Very good. Yep. So that's a good one, because we need a bit of most of the disinfectants and bleaches and stuff we've got, or things for, cleaning our hands properly, are not necessarily desirable. So that's quite a good one, isn't it?
Yes, it is, for sure. Absolutely. It's also, again, rich in lots of nutrients like calcium, magnesium and selenium, which boosts the immune system.
And is difficult to get hold of elsewhere, I think, isn't it, selenium?
Selenium, yeah. I mean, you can find selenium. Garlic's very rich in selenium, because garlic boosts the immune system as well. And there are various other sort of foods in the kitchen. Oysters is one that springs to mind. Not that they're my favourite at all, but they're very rich in selenium as well. But onions and garlic have that, and sulfurs in there to really help the immune and the respiratory system.
And am I right in thinking that to a certain extent you can uptake this stuff more quickly by applying it to your skin through the pores, or as quickly as by eating it?
You can indeed, yeah. If that's your preference, I mean, obviously eating it, again, you have to wait for it to digest. And as I said earlier, we don't normally get a lot of nutrition out of the food we eat, unfortunately. Our skin is the biggest elimination organ we have. It covers our entire body, obviously, you know, covered in pores. And the best way I find to absorb a lot of these kind of nutrients and work, you know, by getting it into the bloodstream a lot faster would be to put it into an oil like a massage oil, whether you're using essential oils or the herb itself that's been steeped and macerated in olive oil, for instance, for 2 weeks, as I mentioned before, just is to use it directly neat on the skin, and the skin will it's absorbed through the pores and goes into the bloodstream and utilized a lot faster that way.
And therefore, also, we are best advised not to put stuff on our skin that we wouldn't actually happily eat.
Yes, absolutely. That's a really sound piece of advice and one that I use myself on a regular basis.
What about rosemary? Because that's another thing that grows well in certain places in the UK, as called.
Yep. Rosemary is another digestive. It's very good for colic and intestinal stuff. But it's also very high in calcium, is a natural antiseptic used externally, and it has a property that and a reputation for strengthening the memory. Rosemary, they say, for remembrance, and they used to put it into reeds and use it at funerals. It stimulates the peripheral circulatory system in the brain. So it will help stimulate sort of memory by supporting the brain and the blood supply to the brain. What I would suggest is that nobody take it in the form of a tea. That's just some rosemary sort of leaves in a tea, you know, steeped in a tea for 3 to 5 minutes. That's hot water, that is, to make a herb tea, incidentally.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have it at night time because it can keep you awake. It's that stimulating.
So what's the best way of using it for these? Well, I mean, there's two things there, aren't there? There's the one so that you're stimulating the peripheral blood systems of the brain, and the one to use it as a disinfectant. How would you use it for those two things?
Okay, well, taken as a tea is very simple. Like I said, you know, using perhaps 1 to 2 teaspoonfuls of fresh herbs, quite strong flavoured, chopped up in a cup of hot water, left for 3 to 5 minutes. You can leave the leaves in the cup if you want, or strain them. That would make a good herb tea taken once or twice a day, but like I said, perhaps not later on in the evening because it could keep you awake. That would stimulate the circulatory system and the blood supply to the brain.
Could you use it late in the evening to keep you awake?
You could use it in the evening to keep you awake if that's what your intention was, yes.
Oh, I do tend to drop off without stimulation.
Okay, well, you could use it instead of a coffee. If you like, you could sweeten it with a little honey if you didn't like the taste of it, but it would be very beneficial in that respect, yes. Mm-hmm. You could also add it to bath water, and again, it's absorbed through the pores of the skin and gets into the bloodstream that way and will make its way to the brain and help with circulatory problems, well, all over the body, but primarily in the head. And then as an antiseptic, you could do a similar thing with the rosemary, making a tea or putting it into vinegar and steeping that for a minimum of 2 weeks, making a sort of rosemary vinegar. And then you could use that by sort of to wipe down your surfaces in your kitchen or anywhere else you needed to, really, as a natural antiseptic.
Great. Another very useful thing to know that. Well, we're in sort of closing to this little section of the program, there's one of your products which is a particular favorite of mine, and we're about to try many of them. We're going to be doing a kidney cleanse soon, and we've got your kidney cleanse formula on hand.
Uh-huh.
And some of your kidney cleansing tea. We've got some of your green stuff to eat and add to the smoothies.
Fabulous.
But one of the things, as you know, that I really, really enjoyed discovering was your tooth powder. Would you like to tell us a little bit about the tooth powder? I think it's brilliant stuff, guys. It really is.
Thank you, Nick. I'm glad you like it. I have a slight addiction to that, and I use it quite regularly. Even when I, you know, even to the point of brushing my teeth several times a day because I actually like the taste of it.
Yeah.
What would you like me to say about it?
Well, if you'd like to tell us sort of roughly what's in it, without giving away any of your trade secrets, of course, and what the benefits are of having them against, you know, in your mouth.
Yeah, for sure. One of the biggest ingredients is bicarb of soda. That alone will freshen the breath, and it helps to very gentle foaming action, but it's renowned for cleaning, stimulating sort of a very gentle clean on enamel on the teeth, without tearing the enamel off, obviously. And it's been used for many years for that effect. There is also lemon and orange peel powder, and a little bit of raw sea salt. All those three will, again, in grain form, just help as a slight gentle abrasive action in cleaning the teeth and whitening them. The orange and lemon peel also contain a lot of vitamin C. So if you were to swallow a little of the tooth powder, it wouldn't do you any harm in boosting the immune system in that way and fighting off infection in the mouth. There is also oak bark powder. Oak bark, I don't know if I've mentioned before on our talk earlier, but oak bark has been renowned again for its astringent properties. So it will help to tighten the gums and also heal any sort of gum disorder, bleeding of gums. And the ancients used to use the tooth, the oak bark twigs as toothpicks to pick between the teeth after they've been eating. So it's in there for those stimulated properties. What else is in there? Let me think. A little bit of Fuller's Earth, which again helps to clean the teeth, again, taken internally, will not do any damage to the digestive system. It helps to sort of draw toxins out of the mouth, but also, like I said, if you swallow it, it will draw toxins out of the colon. And then lastly, there's myrrh resin that I grind up and add for its properties, not least for antiviral, antibacterial and anti-infection properties, for cleaning, keeping the mouth clean of infection. That's also one of the ingredients, or some of those are repeated in my mouthwash, which does a similar thing if you wanted to follow it with that. And then I add essential oils, really. To flavour, I add spearmint and mint, peppermint, and then I generally add a little bit of more orange, mandarin, and a little bit of clove, because clove is still to this day used by dentists in dental preparations to numb the mouth for any pain that might occur in you know, toothache and that sort of thing. And so that's in there for that reason as well.
That works really well as well. I've used clove because, as you know, I have a lot of trouble with my teeth one way and the other. That Fuller's Earth actually deserves perhaps a little bit more attention on the way by, because that's a miracle substance, isn't it?
Yes. No, I use it in, I mean, not least that it's got drawing properties. So like I said, it will help to detox, and it draws impurities out, if you like, and helps to tighten the gums and such. But it's also really quite nice taken internally as a sort of, like I said, an internal cleanser. People have been using clays internally and externally for hundreds of years for washing, for general intestinal health and digestion, for its astringent properties in face masks and skin preparations. Fuller's Earth is and other clays are quite miraculous, considering they just come from the earth, so they're, you know, gifts of nature themselves.
And it's not just humans, apparently. I was reading in Jeremy Narby's book recently about intelligence in nature, that there's parrots over in the South American rainforest somewhere, I think they were, and they're a special brand of parrot that actually eat clay from a cliff that's around where they live, and they eat only a specific sort of clay from there. There's lots of clays available to them, but it's one specific one they go for, and as a result they've given themselves a bit of an environmental kind of hitch because they can eat more poisonous seeds as a result of eating the clay.
Oh, that's fantastic. I didn't know that. Thank you for that information. It doesn't surprise me. I mean, animals in nature, naturally, they kind of steer themselves towards plants and other natural things easily. They do it automatically, really, because they know what's good for them. They actually listen to their bodies. But that's fascinating. I didn't know that about the parrots. That's just really lovely.
Well, it's been a really brilliant chat. Thanks, Mel. And
thank you.
It'd be great to have you on again, because I know that there's other things that we haven't covered this time round.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure, Nick. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. I'll be with you in a sec. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. So far this evening, we've been speaking mostly with Melanie Cardwell about the use of herbs in first aid and for nutrition and generally supporting your internal light body. And now I've got a great friend of mine, the Synchro Sister, with me. She's been on the Dr. Rock show before, first of all talking about a 500-mile walk that was done along the Michael and Mary lines under the name of a project called Awakening Albion. And then she came on after a fairly crazy trip over to Mexico. But one of the things that Synchro spends a lot of time doing is walking about in the Welsh countryside, looking at things that she can browse on in the hedgerow, and generally enjoying the vibe that's out there. So welcome to the show, Synchro.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So one of the first things we're going to talk about is nettles, because Melanie talked about them a bit, about their use in mashed potatoes and stews and soups, and about all the wonderful things that the tips could do with us, and explained that we could continue to enjoy them throughout the year by keeping them trimmed. But I know you've got a few other uses for nettles, haven't you?
Well, yes, I've been learning a bit more about nettles recently at the Green Gathering, in fact, with a very knowledgeable gentleman. We'll mention him later. I discovered that you can eat the flowers which develop the seeds on the nettles as well, and they're really delicious. In fact, you can harvest them now, this time of year, and for the next few weeks probably. They're starting to get really abundant, so it's quite easy to harvest quite a lot in a short space of time. And you can dry them and store them for the winter, add them to stews, breads, things like that. And as with the eating of the nettles, they're full of nutrition, and as somebody said the other day, that the seed is pure potential, basically. So by eating seeds, we're eating the potential of that plant as well. Something I heard recently, which I really liked.
And you can make string out of it as well.
And of course, it's a very useful plant indeed, because you can, at this time of year now, you can collect the red-stemmed nettles, because the fibre on them is slightly stronger and easier to harvest than the green-stemmed nettles. You can make wonderful string out of them. It's probably best to get somebody to show you how to do that. You could probably find a YouTube video or something to show you, but it's great being shown by a real person. And
on that subject, you're going to be running some string making workshops, aren't you? We're thinking of calling them String Theory and Practice.
Indeed, I'd love to do that. And I think it's a very empowering thing to learn how to make string from natural materials. It's something people have been doing for many centuries. And if you're stuffed without a piece of string in the wild and you really need a piece, you can literally harvest some nettles and make a piece of string straight away.
Another thing that Mel mentioned was fat hen, which is very, very common out here in Wales in acid ground and the like. But I know that we ate something that was related to it the other night, didn't we? It was really, really tasty. Can you remind me what it was?
Well, and I only know the common name of it. It's known as a tree spinach. And it's one of its distinguishing features is it has these really bright pink tips, which turn the steaming water pink. And it's really delicious. And it's closely related to fat hen, as far as I know.
So there are a couple of the specifics from Mel's thing that I know you touch on. But I mean, you know, you spend a lot of time in nature. I know you always have done. And I guess my question is, what do you think is the single most important thing that nature has to offer us? How best do we take advantage of it?
Well, simply being in nature, as Mel said, is healing in itself. Spending time in nature, whether you're walking or sitting under a tree, sitting by a river, anything that you do in the world of nature is a healing and an education in itself. Whether you know, you know, you might know nothing about the plants that are growing there, it really doesn't matter. But if you want to develop a relationship with nature, then I think the more we can learn about what's growing, and as Mel said, there's a massive resurgence of an interest in plant knowledge going on at the moment. And the more we can tune into the plants, notice their differences and their similarities, and it helps us to become more aware of our environment, and it forces us to pay attention to detail. We start looking more closely. We start to appreciate the diversity and the beauty of nature more. So, you know, you start maybe with a simple identification book. And I would highly recommend a book by Fred Gillam called Poisonous Plants of Britain, because it's very important when you begin foraging that you understand that there are some very poisonous plants out there, and this book will help you to identify them. It's also full of anecdote and ancient lore about the plants. It's a fascinating little book. And it's produced by a company called Little Wooden Books, which are a marvellous series. There's lots of really wonderful books in there, but Fred Gillam's book, Poisonous Plants of Britain, is an excellent one. And then if you take Fred's book and follow it up with a really good identification book, such as one of the Roger Phillips series of books, they're really excellent. He's done many, many books now. One I would highly recommend is one he did called Wild Food. He's also done a basic guide, or a pretty good guide, to the mushrooms of Britain. And he does wildflowers and trees and everything. Really excellent books. So follow up your identification. If you're wondering what a plant is, you know, bring it home. Have a look in your books. See if you can match it up. Learn about it. And ideally, get somebody who is really sure of their identification of the plants to show you. Because it's a wonderful way to share knowledge, to go out for a walk with somebody who really does know their stuff. And you can learn together, which is a wonderful way of doing things. Not so long ago, I was doing some foraging walks with some friends of mine up at Bodenham Manor. And we went out as a group, and nothing went into the bag for the salad unless it had been positively identified as being edible, safe and tasty. And we had some marvellous salads, mixed salads from the woods there.
What sort of stuff did you find on the hill at Bodenham then?
Well, we had garlic mustard, young hawthorn leaves. We didn't have any of that Ransom's wild garlic, which was a bit of a shame. It was the beginning of the year. May is a really good time for greens from the hedgerows, etc. And young beech leaves are really delicious. They have a lemony flavour, so quite a few of those went in. I can't remember now, but we found many plants to add. We had a big mixed salad every night. We're putting some flowers in there as well from the hawthorn. Some of the flowers went in. All sorts of things, and a really interesting salad was had by all. Really, I think every season has its forageable plants, and you can look out, even in the winter, you can find some fungi that are edible. I know the oyster mushroom, for example, grows in the winter. But when you're out and about, I mean, you can use a camera these days. Maybe take some photographs of the plant and where it's growing so that you can check the ident in your books, or show it to a friend who knows, or even send it to a wonderful, knowledgeable man like Fred Gillam. Apparently he's willing to identify plants that people photograph and send him photographs of, which is really helpful. And so you can take some photographs. You can, if the plant is plentiful, then you can bring home a leaf or a part of a flower to help you identify. Also, you need to be careful where you pick, whatever it is you're picking. You know, you don't want to be picking by the side of a busy main road. You don't want to be picking where farmers have been spraying pesticides, anything like that. And some hedgerows are sprayed with weed killers. And I think people are obliged to put signs up to say that this is the case. And I have found some of those signs. So keep your eyes open. Again, a lot of this stuff is about being observant. And the more we observe, the more we learn. Nature is a great teacher. You shouldn't have any problems once you start investigating, looking closely and checking these things out.
On the subject of mushrooms, which is a bit difficult to do on the radio, really, because so much of the choices are to do with what you can see. But I know you've, firstly, you've got a book which has got a lot of really great, actually hand-drawn pictures of mushrooms. And you might want to talk a little bit with us about how it's set up to make it safe to eat them and find them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, fungi are a massive subject. I really am just touching the tip of the iceberg myself on this topic. There's a lot of people out there who know far more than I do. But as a novice, it's really good to have an excellent book that you can refer to, or several if you want to. There's one I've got called The Collins Field Guide to Edible Mushrooms. And these are drawings in this book, which are incredibly good. I know a lot of books use photographs now, but the drawings are excellent. And what it does is it shows you the edible mushroom and where it's likely to be growing. And then it'll show you any lookalikes which wouldn't be so good to eat, maybe. So it makes it fairly clear. You can be looking for the similarities between the fungi, but also the differences. You can also do a really fascinating thing, which is you can make a spore print from a fungus that you pick and bring home for identification. You turn it upside down on a piece of paper and literally just leave it there, and it will give you a unique spore print for that fungus. And in that really good little book I mentioned, The Collins Guide, they have a picture of the spore print of each of the mushrooms in that book. So that's really helpful. But again, you really can't beat going out with somebody who knows, somebody who has spent many years learning. And there are all sorts of fungal walks going on around the country now. You can find one locally, go out and learn about it with somebody who really knows. And then I often think that getting to know a mushroom is a bit like getting to know a person, because they actually belong to a separate realm. They have their own kingdom in the classification of living things. They have their own fungi kingdom, and they are somewhere between plants and animals. So I do believe that once you have really familiarized yourself with the mushroom growing in lots of different situations, you won't mistake it for anything else. So learn and be very careful.
One of the things about the mushrooms, though, is that one of the reasons why a good book seems to be really helpful is because the ones that are actually going to kill you don't look like any of the edible ones. And the ones that are distinguished in this book as being not the ones to eat are going to make you sick rather than dead. Is that right?
Well, I'd be very careful about any generalisations about the appearance of mushrooms and their edibility. It's something you just have to go into in some depth. Yeah, like, for example, once you get to know a chanterelle mushroom, you can't go wrong. Once you really know it and you break it open and it smells of apricots, it's really delicious. And the lookalikes, although there's nothing that looks exactly like a chanterelle, obviously. And again, you can check the spore print of what you've picked. The lookalikes don't smell like apricots, and it's a very distinct scent.
Yeah, and that's the way it's. I've really enjoyed Synchro's discovery of mushrooms, because I think we're now certainly in double figures on wild mushrooms that we've got in. You can't actually eat all of them. Some of them are better used in sauces, aren't they, and things, because they're.
That's right. There's a really beautiful one called the Amethyst Deceiver, which I believe you found one day.
Oh, yes.
It's a beautiful purple amethyst-coloured mushroom, but it's very, very rich in flavour. And you really only need a few of them to make a difference to a stew, which is fantastic. People are probably familiar with puffballs. They're very difficult to mistake with anything else. And there's a very strange mushroom called the cauliflower fungus. which grows at the base of pine trees. It looks a bit like a large sponge, and it's a very, very strange mushroom indeed, but quite edible. Some might like it.
It's also known as the cauliflower fungus. It's a very weird thing. When you look at it from on top, it kind of looks like seaweed or a bit like a brain. But when you cut it in half, it has something of the texture of and the appearance of a cauliflower. And that indeed is a little bit what it tastes like as well. So it's also called the cauliflower fungus. Before we move on to what we might be finding in the hedgerows at this time of year, Synchro, I know you get a mushroom newsletter from somebody who's particularly informed. Well, you might like to give a word to his services. I'll find his website. Hold on.
Yes, indeed. A man I've had the pleasure of going for some walks with, a man called Dan Butler, who lives near here in Wales. And he runs Fungal Forays. And he also has a really marvellous newsletter that he's willing to send to anybody who sends him their email address. It's very informative. People are sending photographs of their finds in from all over the country. So you might hear, you know, that the porcinis are out in your area so that you can get out there and harvest some after obviously checking the identification. And yeah, I think Nick's put the Dan's website into the... Yeah,
Fungal Forays, I think it was. Yeah, fungalforays.co.uk.
Yeah, and just before we finish this, I'd really like to just mention some of the things that we might be able to find at this time of year, most of which are pretty easily identifiable by most of us. And of course, we're coming into the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, and the hazelnuts, if we can get in before the squirrels, are coming now. Sweet chestnuts are ripening. Blackberries, most people know what blackberries are. If you're lucky enough to have a mulberry tree somewhere near you, they'll be getting ripe now, and you can make a wonderful mess eating mulberries. Bilberries in Wales, I know, are ripe at the moment and are doing pretty well. They're called winberries in other places, and I think there are native blueberry and very delicious if you can find a patch that hasn't been eaten by sheep. Cherries also are ripening, raspberries. Cherry plums, more over in the east, I think, than I've never seen cherry plums growing in Wales, but over in the east of England, I know they're abundant. And then there's damsons and greengages. There's all sorts of things coming up now for harvesting. And one of the best things, really, I think we can do is go out as groups and do communal picking, because you pick so much more, you have a lot of fun. I know one day last year on our Ridgeway walk, everybody set out on our kind of rest day on a little walk, and everybody was given the task of trying to find something to put in the fruit salad that evening. So everybody filled their lunch boxes with blackberries and what else did we find? Apples, cherry plums. We did find cherry plums there. All sorts of things. And we just brought them all together in the evening and made a massive fruit salad and had it with fresh yogurt. And it was a really delicious and fun thing to do. I know when I was a kid, and a lot of people used to, hopefully people still do and are starting to do it more again, the whole family would go out onto the hillside and pick bilberries or blackberries or hazelnuts or whatever. We're also coming into the season of apples, and there's loads and loads of different kinds of apples growing in the wild. Very difficult to tell really what our native crab is like sometimes, because there's so many crosses now with apples from people's gardens. So you can quite often find sweet edible apples growing wild in the hedgerows. You just have to try them. But the crabs themselves, even if they're really sour, they're really good for using in pies and jams and jellies and things like that, because I think they help to set. I think they've got quite a lot of pectin in them. And sloes, of course, they'll be coming up, although they sweeten up after the first frost, but they're quite delicious. Well, yeah, you can make sloe gin, of course. You can make various other things from sloes as well. Elderberries will be coming up, and Mel suggested a nice thing to do with elderberries. It's just a really abundant time of year for wild food.
And of course, by taking all of these things on board, as Mel was saying, we're really improving our physical structure by sampling all of these things. But we don't have to eat stuff from the countryside, do we? You know, all of these fruits, things like the hazel and the oak and all of that, they've all got their own characteristics. And because everything is radiant energy, we can gain some sort of support just by being with these plants, can't we?
Yes, we can indeed. I mean, I think if you look at an old oak tree, a wonderful, majestic old oak tree, you can guess what its qualities might be. And there are many books that you can read around these topics, and fascinating they are. There's loads of old lore about the qualities of trees. But you look at an ancient oak and the way it's standing, you know, it's strong. It's obviously got endurance because it's been there for hundreds of years, and obviously got a lot of patience. And something I find quite interesting, I think, really, when you're out in nature, if you see a nice oak tree or a hawthorn tree or a willow tree or whatever, just use your intuition and go and spend some time with a tree that appeals to you. And you'd probably find then, if you looked it up, it was just what you needed that day. Trees, obviously, really, really amazing, amazing plants. But one thing I discovered recently about them, which I think is really interesting, is that in an oak forest, for example, the trees have fungal mycelia that connect them. So actually all the trees in an oak forest, and probably all of the other plants in the forest as well, are connected by these fungal mycelia that grow under the ground. And the mushrooms that we see are just the fruiting bodies of these mycelia, which are global. They are all over the world. There are fungal mycelia underneath the surface of the earth. And this idea that these trees are connected, in a sense, they can communicate with each other. So not only are they aware of their place in the forest as an entity, as a living entity, they also can communicate with the rest of the forest. And forests can even move, which I found quite an incredible thought when I first came across it. Trees might, an oak forest, for example, might cease to reproduce on one side, but be reproducing more on the other side of the woodland. And over hundreds of years, forests can actually move across our landscape, which makes me think of Lord of the Rings and the Ents.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it? Yeah, yeah, creeping across the face of the planet. Yeah, the mycelium thing's brilliant. I remember when I first discovered that, you know, all these baby oak trees that are kind of establishing themselves from acorns are in fact attached by their own kind of mycelium to the parent plant, and so on, right through the forest. So in effect, all the oak trees and all the beech trees are in communication with each other, and they're supplying each other with information and with various sorts of critical proteins and foods and the like. But I was amazed when Ray Woods, we haven't got a link for Ray, but Ray Woods, lichenologist, L-I-C-H-E-N, somebody I'm sure can find it for me. We'll be able to get some information on Ray. He has an absolutely encyclopedic knowledge of lichens particularly, but he's also really good in the countryside. And I don't know whether you were there at the Willow Theatre when he came round, and he was saying that originally, you know, when the land was all forests and kind of a naturally occurring ground with the occasional human sort of practicing a bit of cursory horticulture, maybe that all of the plants in a given meadow and stuff were connected by mycelium, so that all of them were plugged into this kind of fungal network, and that way the entire system was sorting out enough nutrients and space for the small plants and enough nutrients and space for the big plants, and so the whole thing was working in a balance.
Yes, indeed. And something else that struck me while I was sitting under a tree in Mexico last winter, I had this very strong feeling of community, because of course every tree has its community of insects, birds, fungi, lichen that will only grow and thrive with that tree. So it's like that tree's community is extensive, and they couldn't survive without their community, which is quite an interesting thought. And I also believe that trees know their place, not just in their forest and in the place where they're growing, but I had this sense that trees have an awareness of their place on a global scale. And that's something that I've just been thinking about, because I think it's a very interesting thought. But they know their place in their community, and they could not exist without their community, without their pollinators, the birds eating their insects, keeping everything in balance. And I can't help thinking that us humans could learn something from oak trees and other trees just by spending time with them and watching how they grow and work together.
That's been excellent, Synchro. Thank you very much. And once again, a bit like Mel, I hope that, because obviously things are constantly developing in the countryside and we work together on one or two other things, so it'd be great if you'd consider coming on as a more regular correspondent.
I'd love to. It's a real pleasure to be on the Dr. Rock Show. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it. Thanks, Nick.